Shrink Wrap Radio number 494, The Art of the First Session, with Robert Taibbi, LCSW.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is psychotherapist and author Robert Taibbi, and we'll be discussing how to make psychotherapy count from the very first session. For more information about Robert Taibbi, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, is putting on a year-long online certification course in West African divination and counseling with Maladoma Somme, whom I interviewed on episode number 444. For information and sign up, go to jungplatform.com/courses. Robert Taibbi, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, thank you. Good to be here, Dave. I appreciate your reaching out to me.
Yeah, well, I'm really pleased to have this opportunity to talk about you and about your new book, which I gather is just hot off the press. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about how you first got started in psychotherapy.
I'm an old-timer, Dave. I've been doing this 41 years.
Yeah, good for you.
And most of it's been in community mental health. I worked in South Carolina for a bunch of years at a family service agency and was a clinical director down there, and then had an opportunity to move to Charlottesville, Virginia. I've been here since the mid-80s. And I was a child and family director for the mental health center here. But I also started doing writing. I started doing magazine work. I started doing journal writing. And then I started writing books on supervision and family and couples therapy. They used them as textbooks. And then I started going on the road.
Let's step back further. I was wondering, what was it about being a psychotherapist that made you want to be one way back in the day?
Yeah, I tell the story in one of my workshops. And I was actually... You know, I graduated from college like a sociology major, whatever that was.
Back then.
And, you know, and I had this plan of going to get a PhD in sociology and was actually offered a full scholarship for a PhD program. And I happened, this was back in the 70s, they happened to have some peer counseling program started on campus. And I signed up for it.
Where was that? What campus was that?
It was at Rutgers.
Okay.
And, so I signed up as a volunteer, and it was kind of this touchy-feely 1970s stuff where we would sit around in circles on big pillows, and people would talk about themselves.
Hey, don't put it down. I came up through that same period, and I'm very much into touchy-feely.
what was startling about that for me was my mother had died when I was 12, and I was the classic case of unresolved grief. I just stuffed it. And kind of live from the head up, and, you know, I was the good student who was also shoplifting and drinking heavy and all kinds of other stuff. And then I got involved with this peer counseling thing, and I thought it was interesting, and people were crying, and it was sort of startling to me. And then I met a guy who actually worked with my wife who did research in alcoholism, and he was a social worker. He was a nice guy. And he started talking about social work, and he was a nice guy. And I go, wow, social work, that sounds interesting. And they were starting a new program down in South Carolina at the time, and they only had a class to 30. And for some reason, I decided to, I'm going to go to social work school. And I was also getting out of New York. I was young 20s, married with kids where the grandparents are hounding us to come over every weekend.
Right.
So 800 miles away sounded like a great idea. So I went to social work school, and even when I finished there, 2 years later, I did really well. I got to go, okay, I want to go back and probably do academics, or I want to get a PhD and do research. But I said, I have to get a job. I mean, no one's going to get me into a PhD program without some kind of work experience. So I got a job on Main Street in Columbia, South Carolina, of all places, coming out of New York, and had culture shock.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But I started seeing people who were opening up to me, you know, and they were crying and they were talking about things they never talked to anybody about. And what I talk about for me, and what I always, when I tell this story, is I got hooked because it was controlled intimacy. And for somebody like me who was wounded, somebody like me who sort of had kind of squashed down a whole lot of emotion because of my mother's loss, mm-hmm. this kind of opened me up, and I got hooked by this. And I never went back. I never went back to do the research stuff. I never went back for the PhD stuff, and have stayed with it since.
Yeah. Well, did you get into therapy yourself at some point?
Yes, I did.
Or was it all vicarious learning through your clients?
Well, I'll have to admit some of it, or a big chunk of it, probably was vicarious. But yeah. No, I did. I got into therapy myself. Went into couples therapy at one point, and so yeah, I got my feet wet as well. But it was, you know, it was that old adage that you do therapy until you heal yourself, and then you go into administration. So
yeah. Well, I've been enjoying your book, The Art of the First Session: Making Psychotherapy Count from the Start. And I gather there are other books out there on the first session. What makes yours unique?
Yeah, I mean, when I was doing the review on this, when I had the idea, most of the books that I've noticed are about what to do in terms of assessment type stuff. Most mm-hmm. of the books that I've seen are about, you know, what kind of questions do you want to ask? What kind of mental status exam? What kind of things do you look for? You know, how do you essentially do a, you know, how do you kind of run that in terms of content? And in the last couple of years, I've been particularly interested in brief therapy, and I've written a couple of books on that. And so I've always had this kind of fantasy in my head about what would be the perfect first session. And I'm also coming out of a community mental health background where, you know, even though I'm in the private practice now, back, you know, for most of my working life, those people who are coming, they only come a few times. Mm-hmm. You know, we have, obviously, if you work in community mental health, you have some seriously mentally ill folks who are going to be coming for a long time. But for a lot of folks, they're coming in and they're looking for Dr. Phil. You know, they're coming in and they want advice, and they want you to tell them, they want you to straighten out their kid and do sessions, or they want something. So I got used to working in that kind of environment.
Yeah.
And so I started reading books about selling, you know, just the art of selling type stuff. And I was curious about, because you can't not sell. Essentially, that's what you're doing in a first session. You know, you're essentially, like it or not, you're trying to convince the people who are sitting across the room from you that your approach and your personality are going to be a good fit for them. You know, you cannot not do that.
Yeah,
that's what they're coming for.
Yeah, that's definitely the distinguishing feature, I think, of your book, is that there is a kind of a focus on selling throughout. And on the face of it, that might sound crass, but I totally believe, you know, what you're saying in the book, that is an aspect of the work. And I was particularly impressed by your discussion of how psychotherapy has changed since we were in graduate school in the last 10, maybe even 20 years, that the whole environment has changed radically. And I actually got out of private practice before all these big changes happened. Maybe I was sensing them coming. But take us through some of those changes, because I thought that was a terrific discussion.
Yeah, I remember you asked me if I had been in therapy before. Yes, back in my youngin' days, you know, the way you would find a therapist is you'd hopefully get a best friend and catch him in the lunchroom at work and in these discreet, hushed tones say, hey, do you know anybody who does something? You would have no idea of their background. All you would do is get a name and maybe a phone number, and you'd have to look it up in a phone book. And you would kind of show up and maybe kind of take what you got or not. You know, I mean, a lot of folks who came to the mental health center, they were coming because somebody referred them, and they had no idea what to expect.
Sure.
You know, what's changed? You know, what? You know, there are various statistics on this, but when you look at stats of people going into therapy, you know, one stat is that 70% of clients now are getting their information from online searches.
Yeah, I was fascinated by that.
Yeah,
makes total sense.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, it just happened. I got an email this morning from this woman, and she said, I'd like to contact you for couples therapy because I read one of your articles on my Psychology Today blog. And by the way, I live in Japan.
So
can we Skype? You know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, this would have been impossible.
And I want to come back to the Skype idea towards the end of our discussion, because that was something I was going to ask you about. But go ahead.
But what you have now is people who are going online, they're looking at profiles, they can compare different therapists, they get to see your picture, you know, see if it reminds you of their father or mother or somebody.
Yeah.
And this is very different. And so people are coming in, I think, much more knowledgeable than they were before. Now, again, you're going to have some group of clients that aren't. You know, they're referred by courts or they're referred by doctors and they've never been in therapy before. But for a big bunch of folks, that's probably pretty true. So they have expectations.
Yeah, you know? And they've read your profile. They probably read 10 or 15 others.
That's right.
And they're like shoppers, right?
That's absolutely. I mean, the other stat you're looking at is that, you know, most people, they go one time. You know, when you look at...
That was astounding to me.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing you remember from your statistics course in college, you know, you have median, mode, and whatever the other one is. But the mode is the most frequent number of things that show up in a sample. And most people go once. The average length of therapy is 5 to 8 times, and most people go one time. So is there pressure on you to sell yourself? I think so, you know.
There must be
with expectations.
Yeah, there must be a lot of depressed therapists out there who, if they haven't seen this statistic, you know, they're going to think, it must be me. But actually, it might not be.
The answer is, it is you, maybe.
But it is you, yeah. But it is you because you haven't sold yourself successfully.
Right. Yeah, when I was working at Mental Health Center at one point, the agency decided to go towards a centralized intake system for a lot of reasons. You know, they had to get a lot of material for the state databases and all kinds of other stuff, and they had people have to sign HIPAA forms and whatever. But they would have people come in, and they would spend a whole lot of time filling out forms, and then they would kind of get a summary of what their presenting problem was. And then at the end of 45 minutes, they would go, well, thanks for coming, and, you know, Mr. Taby will give you a call in the next week or so and set up an appointment. I really had a hard time with that because people, again, had expectations. Even if they were kind of told they were going to have to do paperwork, people had taken time off from work. People, you know, they were in crisis mode. They were in some kind of thing. And then they come in, and then they spend, you know, 30 minutes or 45 minutes filling out paperwork, and they expect to go to the doctor.
Right.
You know, they're expecting, when you go to the doctor, you don't sit out for paperwork, and the doctor tells you, we'll call you back in 2 weeks to have you come back in.
Yeah.
And one of the things I use that as an analogy in the beginning of my book is, you know, one of the things that, you know, we can think about it in terms of sales. You know, it's not a whole lot different than buying a car or buying a refrigerator in some way in terms of how do you help people understand what your products are and how do you help them feel confident in your abilities. But the better analogy is probably your family doctor. You know, if you wake up with a huge rash on your arm at 9 o'clock on Monday morning and you start to freak out, probably the first thing you do is you're going to go online and look at WebMD or something.
That's
you're looking at pictures of people's rashes.
Yeah.
And then you find one that looks like yours and you go, oh my God, it's this African mange. And your arm is going to fall off in 3 days, according to what the WebMD says. And so you make an appointment with your doctor, and you show up, and you're all nervous, and you're scared, and, you know, what does the doctor do? Well, the doctor looks at it, and they start asking you a bunch of questions. You know, have you been out in the woods? Have you eaten anything? Does it itch? You know, how long does it last? Have you put anything on it? Blah, blah, blah. And then at the end of that, she says, it looks to me like you got contact dermatitis, you know, and here's some cream. It's a sample. Put it on for 3 days. If it doesn't clear up, call me back. You know, if it's not that, we'll do a blood test and see if we can rule out something else. She does this in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and Do you feel better? Absolutely you feel better. Because you thought you had this horrible African mange, and now you find out that no, it's something. And she's telling you right then and there, here's the plan. Here's the treatment. You're going to try this stuff for 3 days, and if it doesn't work, we're going to try something else.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of, you know, I believe in therapy, but I also believe that therapy ought to be more like that, where people have kind of some kind of expectation. I see a lot of, not a lot, but it seems like, I always ask in my first session, have you guys been in therapy before? If I'm seeing a couple or a family or an individual, and they say, sure. And I said, how come you didn't go back to see whoever it was before?
Yeah, good question.
What I often hear, maybe more so from couples than individuals, but they go, you know, she was nice, you know, he was a nice guy, but, you know, we didn't say much, you know, and he just kind of asked us how we felt, and, you know, we kind of felt like we were just kind of having the same conversation with him that we had at home, and it really wasn't any different. I want to hear that because I want to know what not to do.
Yeah.
But the other side of that is hearing their frustration. You know, they had expectations that something was going to happen, and it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, and they're even patient. Well, you know, the research shows people go 5 to 8 times. That's a pretty long time before people drop out. But they have expectations, and if they're feeling like we're spending 3 sessions just kind of doing assessment, and they have no feedback, or the person is non-directive, and they're just kind of listening, and we're kind of replicating in the session what we could do at home for free, then you go, well, why do I need this?
Yeah, that makes a powerful case. And another stat that you give is that 70% of clients drop out before reaching their goals.
That's right.
So it sounds like an awful lot of therapy these days is short-term therapy, whether that was the therapist's plan or not.
Yeah.
And I can see why you were drawn then to steep yourself in the short-term therapy approach.
Right. Yeah.
Did that come easily for you? I mean,
well, again, because of my background in community mental health, you mm-hmm. know, the reality check is most of our work on an outpatient basis was exactly that.
Yeah.
You know, people didn't even have the money or the resources or to be able to take time off from work. They're not going to come for 6 months. You know, we had to do kind of behavioral, short-term kind of work. So I'm comfortable with that. And you know, I'm a pretty behavioral kind of guy. And so I feel that works, you know, just in my own clinical approach. I tell people, you know, I don't want you to come here and we just got to complain. I'm going to give you homework. You know, here's things I want you to try to do at home to kind of change what you're doing or change the pattern in your relationships. Just so that's what the work of therapy is. It isn't just you coming to me and tell me about your week.
Yeah,
I have concerns about that, too. I mean, there's ethical issues about creating dependency and things like that.
Yeah. So they say we only have one chance to create a first impression.
That's right.
And so that you're kind of applying that idea to the first session of psychotherapy and how crucial that first session is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the whole point of the book is, you know, everybody's going to have, you know, their own clinical approach and their own clinical style. The point of the book is just to help people think about being intentional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't just kind of go on autopilot. Don't just treat a first session like you would treat a fourth session. You know, it isn't the same thing. And I'm saying, you know, if you want people, you know, people need to, you know, I have a big thing in my book about changing the emotional climate, but people need to feel different when they walk out than when they walked in.
Yeah.
You know, that's what happens when you go to your family doctor. You walk out feeling better because she told you what's wrong with you, and she gave you some kind of treatment plan that makes you feel like this can be fixed. You know, people need the same thing. They need to feel either emotionally different, or they need to have another way of looking at the problem because you educate them about the problem in a different kind of way, or they need to have, you've done something in the session that gave them a different emotional experience where they went from being angry to now being more reflective. That's the stuff that's going to make a difference. And
yeah.
Then they'll come back.
Yeah, most people wouldn't think that you could write a 200-page book about the first 40 minutes or the first hour.
Right.
But not only have you done so, but actually with a lot of specificity, a lot of very concrete ideas in a way you're delivering on the right. promise of the first session. So let's talk about some of the skills that are critical sure. for the first session. You've got a whole yeah. lot to say about that. And one was the one you just mentioned about changing the emotional climate. Talk
right.
about some of the other issues.
Yeah, well, the first one, and this probably reflects more my orientation than anything else, that, you know, I talk about five skill sets that you need to have in terms of kind of running a good first session. And one of them, which is tied to sales very much, is the idea that you want to be in lockstep with a client in terms of process. One of the things I always wind up talking about in my books and workshops is when I see clients for the first time, essentially we're talking two different languages. Most clients who come to you or come to me are talking the language of content. They want to tell a story. They want to tell you why it happened on Tuesday and at what time. Again, I work with a lot of couples. They both have two different stories. You know,
yeah.
they start arguing about whether it was Tuesday or Wednesday or what time it was or who did what or here's the checkbook or whatever. And what I usually wind up saying to these kind of folks somewhere in the middle of that session is, I don't say it this bluntly, but the concept is, I don't particularly care what you talk about. I'm curious why you can't solve these problems on your own.
Uh-huh.
And so my idea about therapy is helping people change their process, change what they do. But the other side of this is, I need to do this in the room. So one of the things that comes from sales, for example, a thousand years ago, when I was in college, I actually sold encyclopedias.
Okay.
Now, encyclopedias were books that we don't have books anymore, and we don't have encyclopedias. but I would actually bang on doors in the winter of New Jersey and try to sell people sets of Britannic encyclopedias or something.
Yeah.
It was an awful job. It lasted about 2 weeks. But we had training for this job, which lasted about 10 minutes. And essentially what the training was giving you a pitch that you would give to families. So if you ever got in the front door and you sat in the living room, you would say, you would do your pitch. And part of it would be, say, you know, well, one of the things that's good about having an encyclopedia in your house is now your kid has ready access to information. You don't have to take them to the library in the winter. You don't have to worry about the other kid in his class took the S volume on snakes and you can't get it. You got the information right there. And then you're looking for it. So you can see how this would be helpful for your kids. And now you're looking for these people to nod their heads. And then they nod their heads and you go, and one of the things that happens is you don't have to worry about this thing getting old because we have an annual book, and for $50 a year you buy the annual book and it brings you all up to date on whatever. And so you can see how this will help you keep current. And they nod their heads yes. And you kind of go down the line. If you get yeses all the way down the line, when you say, and it only costs you three payments of $5,000, they'll go, great, sign me up. Where they get stuck is, or where you get stuck is, you give your pitch about the encyclopedia, and then you talk about the annual book, and they make a face, and you don't do nothing. You don't catch it. And what happens is, they have some doubt, they have some hesitation that you didn't pick up on. And when you tell them it's three payments of $5,000, they're going to go, we're going to think about it.
Yes, right.
And so one of the tools in terms of what salesmen are always looking at, or saleswomen are always looking at, is you want to be in lockstep. You know, so the equivalent for clinical work would be, if I say, it sounds like this person reminds you of your mother, and you make some kind of interpretation, for example, you want this person to respond. If they make a face, if they go, I'm not sure, you want to stop. You don't want to move forward. You want to clarify that right then. When you make a connection between a child's behavior and maybe the child has ADHD or something like that, you want to get everybody to nod their heads. And so one of the skill sets is that. You need to track this really, really closely. You want to make sure everybody is in step with you as you move down the line.
Mm-hmm.
Because when it comes to present your treatment plan or to talk about next steps, or give them homework, or whatever it is, you've already clarified and pushed to the side any kind of obstacles that may come up.
Yeah, so in other
words,
that's
really important, and that's the skill set. What happens for a lot of new clinicians is they get caught in the content.
Yeah.
They get caught in the story, which is why the progress notes of beginning clinicians are like 500 pages.
Right.
because they write everything down.
Yes.
You know, they get overwhelmed by the, it's not about that. It's about process. So that's one of the, you know, that's one of the key sets of skills that you want to have.
Yeah.
The other one that you started mentioning is the one about emotional climate. And this is the idea that people need to feel different when they walk out than when they walk in. And again, you know, a lot of great therapists, or even not even great therapists, a lot of therapists have experience that they instinctively know how to do this. But again, it's about being intentional so that you take care of those opportunities and pay attention to them in that first session. You know, so things that you can do for that are things like focusing on what I call soft emotions. You know, a lot of, again, I see a lot of families and couples, they come in angry. You know, they're not coming in sad, they're coming in angry. And, you know, what I'm looking for is, if I see somebody start to tear up, I'm going to say, I'm going to stop the action and go, Mary, what just happened? You know, you're looking sad. And I'm going to sound like that on purpose because I want to get under her defenses.
Sure.
And hopefully Mary will soften up.
Uh-huh.
You know? Or if somebody's angry about something, I'm going to go, Ed, it sounds like you're angry, but what are you worried about? What are you afraid of? And again, I'm going to sound like that on purpose.
Uh-huh.
But the idea here is to kind of change the climate.
Yeah.
You know, to kind of get into opposite emotions or soft emotions. And again, the other skills that most people have. You know, you want to, when people talk about we don't get along, I want to know exactly what not get along means.
Yes.
You know, because it's in the details of language that people get into their emotions, and that kind of changes what's kind of going on. You know, reframing problems is obviously a way of changing the climate. Your kid isn't a bad kid. Johnny's not a bad kid. Johnny's got ADHD, and what this means is that his brain doesn't work the same as you. Do you feel better? Do the parents feel better? Absolutely. Because now they have a new way of looking at Johnny.
Right.
You know,
right.
And so you use education, you reframe problems, you know, and again, the goal is to help people feel differently than they walked out. The point here is you want to be intentional about that. You want to look for those opportunities.
Now, you also, another skill that you go into is called preparing ahead.
Yeah.
And how can you prepare ahead for somebody you haven't seen yet?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I talk, I mean, there's a couple of parts to that. One is, you know, the first impression thing you mentioned, you know, what kind of first impression do you want to make? So, I mean, there's a lot of information out there now about creating your own website, and everybody should have one. I've seen other people's websites, and you probably have too, where they're kind of generic. You know, they talk about, you know, come for caring, supportive, you know, professional services, and they have this kind of dreamy background and whatever. When you look at research and when you look at even, you know, feedback you probably get from couples, what motivates people are problems. You know, I work with enough publishers and editors in the past around self-help kind of stuff. And they say, you know, what sells books are not, you know, generic kind of treatment approaches. It's about specific problems, you know, what to do about anxiety, what to do about your kid who's acting up at school, whatever. And so preparing ahead is also partly helping people understand exactly what problems you focus on.
Uh-huh.
So they know that you're the right guy to come to about that.
Yeah.
You do know how to work with kids around those. So you do know how to help people with anger management issues.
We're all going to go look at your website now.
And critique it and tear it apart. You know, same thing with, you want to sound professional because, again, people have expectations. You know, inadvertently called up, you know, therapists and, you know, for various reasons. And you hear these voicemails where they're mumbly or they, you know, you hear kids running around in the background or, you know, and you wonder, what's, are they at home in their kitchen? What's going on here? The other part, though, is, you know, again, impressions. You know, I think it's really important, for example. I can't tell you many people tell me, they said, you know, I got a list of names from my doctor, people to call. I've already called 10 people in the last 3 days. You're the first person to call me back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where people are saying, nobody calls them. You know, people don't respond. And I'm saying, most people who are calling up for therapy are in crisis or assume they're pretty close to it. And you want to be on it. You know, what I do is even if I don't have the time to talk to people right away, I'll call them up and just say, hi, Mary, just want to let you know I did get your message and I'm tied up today, but I will call you back at 5:00. So Mary isn't left hanging. And you can't believe how people appreciate the courtesy and the responsiveness. in that. And I also suggest to people that they leave time. You know, you leave 10 minutes. You're not going to do therapy over the phone, but leave enough time so people don't feel rushed, you know, so you can answer their questions. A lot of times their questions are about insurance or where your office is located or something about your approach. And again, I don't think you should do therapy on the phone, but you want to leave time so people feel like you're being patient with them. The other big thing that's part of preparing ahead is, ideally, and this is me talking, you want to give people something by the end of the session. One of the things you want to do is be like your family doctor, and what you want to leave them with is some kind of preliminary treatment plan. So what this means in terms of your preparing ahead is if you have somebody calls up and said, I need help with anxiety, or I need help with anger management, or I'm having a problem with depression, you want to be able to hit the ground running. You know, this is what your doctor does. You know, your doctor may not know about African mange or whatever, but she probably knows about the most common skin rash kind of things that come through her door. And she has in her mind exactly, she's ruling out, you know, the various things it could be. That's why she asks you the questions. The being able to be prepared ahead is you want to have what I call treatment maps in place. You want to have a map in your head for people who have OCD, for example, if you do that kind of work, or for ADHD in adults, or for couples where somebody's had an affair. You know, you want to know, you want to have some kind of skeleton, even if you don't know the particular details of that client, you need to have something in place so your first session, you're hitting the ground running. You're using your time for assessment to just kind of fine-tune what you already have as a plan in your head. So when time's running out at the end of the session, you can present them with something about what you're going to be doing.
Going back to the doctor, a lot of times the doctor will hand you two or three pages of something that they've printed off the internet.
That's
probably.
Right. That's
probably.
Right. Yeah.
And I just wonder, do you do that? Do you have?
I do that.
You
I
have
do
some
that a
handouts?
Lot.
Uh-huh.
I do. I use. I have a lot of articles from my past writing stuff and things on my Psychology Today blog and whatever. So I have a lot of material handy, but oftentimes I'll either give it to them as a summary of what I already said in the session because I realize they can't process everything I might have said. You know, so here's
That's
something
right.
they can process on their own. It's sort of a transitional object, if you want to
yeah.
think in that kind of a term.
Right.
You know, or it's just information, you know, that we hadn't covered that it gives them a chance to kind of get a better idea of how I'm thinking and also what the treatment plan is going to be like.
Yeah.
So I think that's a great idea. So I have a whole bunch of them that I hand out to folks.
Yeah, interesting.
And doctors are doing the same thing, right?
Yeah, and speaking of transitional objects, which is a psychoanalytic term, you talk about anticipating transference issues.
Yes, yes.
How do you anticipate, again, before you've met the person?
Yeah, I'm not, you know, quite frankly, I'm not psychoanalytic and I'm not even heavily psychodynamic. What I mean by this, though, is, you know, sort of the simple concept is you don't want to trigger people's emotional wounds. You know, what you don't want to do is, you know, I'm always aware in my mind if I'm working with a family or if I'm working with a couple, I need to be the ideal parent or I need to be the ideal partner or I need to be the ideal whatever. What that means is I want to be careful. You know, one of the things I talk about in my book is I have this model of there's four ways people get resistant or four ways people kind of back out of therapy. One of them is that you guys aren't on the same page about the problem. You're trying to, this is where, you know, you think you got an African mange and the doctor thinks you got contact dermatitis and you ain't buying it. And so you don't go back or you think the doctor's missing something. But if we're not on the same page about stuff or that you're going too fast, too slow, this is where you're doing a six-session evaluation and they want Dr. Phil and they want some kind of feedback in 20 minutes, they ain't going to come back. But one of them is about that you step on their emotional wounds. So what I'm looking for in the session is, for example, it's easy to do with couples and families because you know what the other person doesn't like. You know what the clients don't like. You know, if a wife, for example, is complaining about her husband always being too critical, I got to be really careful in that session that I don't sound critical even when I ask my questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody makes an individual makes a passing reference to the fact that their mother was sort of neglectful or not attentive or never appreciated anything they did, note to self, one of the things I got to be careful about doing is not doing that, or actually do the opposite. I'm going to appreciate what they do. I'm going to listen attentively because I don't want to step on that wound. And that's, and you can pick this up pretty quickly if you're looking for it. And again, the idea here is, what don't you want to do? You know, if you can kind of pick out two or three things that you know you don't want to do, that'll help you, the client, feel safe. That's what you're shooting for. I mean, when we talk about building a rapport and all the other stuff that's important in first sessions, basically what we're doing is we're trying to create an environment where people feel safe and confident in you. And,
yeah.
And again, the whole point of talking about this is you need to be intentional about this. It ain't going to happen just because you wore your favorite tie to work that day.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to be on what you do.
You know, another thing you talk about is controlling the clock, which I gather would be about sort of pacing yourself in the session.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a limited amount of time.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, what do you want? How do you?
Yeah.
Are you moving along the way that you need to be moving along?
Right. And there's, I mean, there's two other parts to this. One is that, again, the surgeon, again, my pitch is you're doing a pitch. You know, my idea is, ideally, you have a certain amount of ground you want to cover, you know, and if you're agreeing with me that part of that is you want to give clients some kind of either feedback about their problem or some kind of preliminary treatment plan, the same way your doctor does, you got to back it up. you got to make sure you cover what you need to cover in order to do that. Again, you know, my experience at the mental health center is, you know, people would show up and they'd fill out the paperwork and go, whoa, we're out of time. And so same time next week. And people go, what the heck was that? I just paid $60 or just took time off from my job for nothing? Are you kidding me? Are they going to come back? No, they're not going to come back.
Well, it's kind of a joke, you know, about psychotherapy. The psychotherapist who says, sorry, your time's up. Or sorry, the hour's up.
Yeah.
And so how do you... I'm going to say push your agenda, which is probably three wrong words in there, without without making them feel pressured.
Well, it's about, I don't think of it as pressure as much as leadership. Mm-hmm. Again, some people have been in therapy before, and they may have a different impression of it. You know, if they had gone to somebody who was more non-directive or whatever, they may walk out of that experience with a different expectation. But part of that is I clarify that when I talk to people on the phone, you know, or they look at my website, I tell them it's going to be interactive. You know, I'm not one to just nod my head. But the other part of that is it's you want to control the clock because you want to make sure things get covered for them.
Yeah.
And so what I talk about in the book is one way of looking at this, at the first session, is divided up into thirds. You know, so the first 15, 20 minutes is going to be about them. It's going to be about you kind of doing small talk. You're going to introduce yourself. You're going to help them feel comfortable in the room. But then they're going to tell their story, either as an individual or a couple, whatever it is. They're going to tell their story. What you don't want to do with couples and families, you don't want somebody dominating. You don't want Mary to melt down and cry for 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Because that's going to kill the session. But you're going to leave that 15, 20 minutes. The second part of it is about you. So now you've gotten their information, and this is what your doctor does when after you show her your arm or you explain to her your symptoms, she starts asking questions. Did you go out in the woods? Did you eat anything? Whatever. You're going to do the same thing. This is where, based on your clinical model, you're going to spend time going, okay, you know, have you ever taken medication? You know, do you feel bad in the morning? Do you do whatever it is that you need to know in order to fill out your diagnosis? You already have a hypothesis in your head. You already have some semblance of a treatment plan just based on what their presenting problem is. But you're filling it out now by asking questions. Have you tried this? Have you done that? What happens? What do you do when you argue? Whatever it is. The third part of it is you need to now link the two parts together. You know, so now what your challenge is you whatever they came in for that's motivating them, their presenting problem, their kid or their marriage or them and their depression, whatever it is, and you already gathered information, you have to take what you've learned about them from your assessment and link it to their concerns. You know, I think what happens, what's difficult for a lot of beginning clinicians is they don't do that part. They don't link it to the client's concerns. They come up with their own hypothesis, but they don't speak the language that helps the client see the connection.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what you need to do is be able to do that. You know, it sounds like you're concerned about your son and his behavior in the classroom, but after talking to you, I'm concerned that he may have ADHD, and the reason why he has so much trouble in class paying attention is because of blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and by the way, I want to let listeners know that you've got a lot of sample dialogues in the book.
That's
so,
right, yeah.
So, which really helps to concretize a lot of what you're saying.
Right, thank you. And But you have a certain amount of time because you need to leave 15, 20 minutes to kind of wrap it up.
Yeah.
And I was running out of time.
Yeah. I was also interested in your use of the word leadership, demonstrating leadership, which
right.
I don't think I've ever read that in any therapy book.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Just that word. I mean, I'm not disputing
it. Yeah, I write about it all the time.
Yeah, I'm not
disputing it. In my books on couples and family therapy, you need to have that because otherwise – you need to have leadership for two reasons. One is people are looking to you to be in charge.
Yeah.
You know, again, I've met tons of people where they get frustrated with clinicians because the clinicians are essentially being reactive and just sitting there. You know, and I know there's the whole, you know, non-directed school of doing therapy, but people have expectations. But the leadership part, too, is if they know you're in charge without being controlling, they can feel safe. You know, this is what helps people feel safe.
Yeah,
that you're on top of things, uh-huh. That you're listening, that you know what you're doing. This is what your doctor does because that's why she wears the white coat and the stethoscope.
Well, speaking of the white coat, and you talk about the need to present oneself professionally. How do you dress?
I know. I actually looked at. There is the research. They actually had the research on that with the doctors, and they found out that. They did the same pitch with it was actors, but they had the same pitch to three different audiences of patients of whatever that was. But they changed in terms of they had like a scrub outfit, a white coat with no stethoscope, and the white coat with the stethoscope. And even though the pitch was the same, the folks who got the white coat and the stethoscope felt that the doctor was actually more competent and felt more likely to go see that person.
Interesting. So how have you translated that into your practice?
Well, I think you need to be sensitive. The rule of thumb, I think, is you dress up to increase your authority and dress down when you need to. You know, back in my 20s, when I was doing therapy, when I started out, I was talking to people who look like my parents. You know?
Yeah.
I was talking to people in their 40s and 50s,
right.
And they were coming in for marital problems.
Fortunately,
I was married, so I wasn't, you know, they weren't going and say, you got kids, you know, and I go, oh, no, you know, what do you know about raising kids?
Right.
I didn't do that, but I'd wear three-piece suits, you know. It was my armor, but it was also, you know, trying to convey something about some kind of professionalism and authority when I didn't have a whole lot going on.
Yeah.
So you want to be sensitive to that. You know, if I'm seeing a CEO of a company, and I know he's coming from work and he's going to be wearing a suit, I'll probably dress up for that. If I got a teenager coming in who's 14, you know, and I may dress down. I'm not going to do a three-piece suit.
Uh-huh.
So you want to be, you know, so you want to be sensitive to it. You know, you don't have to wear construction boots because you got a guy who's, you know, does construction. But there is a certain amount of matching, and there is a certain amount of expectation. You know, one of the things about rapport building is that kind of matching of tone and how you talk and how you dress and whatever. So you need to be conscious of it. Again, just don't throw in anything because you run out of clothes for the day and need laundry. Be aware.
What about self-disclosure? What's an appropriate amount of self-disclosure, particularly in a first session?
This gets... you know, I think this is a matter of style and a matter of orientation. You know, I think folks who are more psychodynamic or psychoanalytic are real cautious about doing that. I'm not. I mean, my style tends to be fairly open and fairly interactive. I mean, from a selling perspective, you know, one of the things salespeople talk about is creating similarities. The more clients or consumers or customers see that there's a similarity between you and them, they're more likely to like you, and they're more apt to listen to you and respect your opinion. And so the idea of self-disclosure is in terms of helping to build similarities. I don't have to sit there and tell you my life story, you know, but, you know, if I have kids and they have kids and I'm, you know, and if I'm a few years younger than them, I'll put a one-liner in just mentioning my kids, you know, or, you know, somebody says they were in the military, I'll go, yeah, I remember, you know, 30 years ago I was in the Army too. It was way different from now. And again, it's not being manipulative. It's a clinical decision, and it's not, you know, and I'm not expounding on my life, but it's a clinical decision to help people feel comfortable.
Yeah, part of the key, I think, is what you said is you throw in a one-liner because it's very easy to go off on your own life story.
You think you got problems, right? Right, you don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Right. But again, it's going to depend on your orientation. You know, again, there's the blank screen kind of thing. Again, that's not my style. But I am going to use that judiciously, and I'm going to be conscious about it. You know, and then as I get to know, you know, folks, I may change that to some degree. But I think that's another tool in your toolbox to help people again feel safe to build rapport with them. I think it's fine.
Yeah. Okay, so I can read a book on therapy, maybe a book like yours, and there are all these kinds of case vignettes and examples, and so I go off, I'm armed with all of this, and then somehow sometimes life doesn't go the way that it goes in a book.
Don't you hate that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got a chapter you've titled First Session, First Aid. Which kind of addresses that idea that there may be bumps in the road.
Sure.
So let's talk about some of those bumps. One is the resistant client.
I started talking about this before, but, you know, there's the whole psychotherapy literature that talks about client resistance, you know, and in some approaches that's considered a given. My approach is a little bit different. I'm saying if clients are resistant, it's because you've done something wrong, basically. You know, so then I'm back to what I was talking about before. Either, you know, they seem to be resistant because you're not agreeing about the problem or you're not agreeing on the treatment plan. You know, this is where the car salesman tries to push this car on you that you have no interest in, you know, and you're feeling like you're being railroaded into something you don't want. You know, the idea of poor pacing, where you're going too fast or too slow. People, you want to know about this. I mean, part of one of your goals for this first session is you want to get a sense of their expectations about therapy. You can get this by finding out what their experience was in therapy before. You can ask them directly. But you want to get an idea of what they're looking for, or you want to, when you present your treatment plan and say, I want to spend the next two or three sessions looking, you know, spending time with your son and do play therapy, and then I'll give you feedback. You want to make sure they nod their heads and agree with you that this is where they want to go. So you want to clarify all this. So the resistant client, you know, can come from that. You know, so when people start saying, we'll give you a call, your next question to yourself is, what would happen here? You know, is it really a logistic problem or something's wrong? Now, what I think is if you have any suspicion that something went wrong, either say it then or call the people back. You know, for example, again, I work with a lot of couples. And if I walk out with this, any kind of a twinge where I felt like maybe, like the husband, for example, felt a little, I came on too strong to him, or maybe he felt a little bit ganged up on between me and his wife, feeling that way, or whatever it was, or he didn't get enough time to talk, you know, for whatever reason, he didn't get enough time to kind of get out his story well enough, I'm going to call him up. You know, next day, I'm going to go, hey, Ed, you know, thanks for coming in. And, you know, I was thinking about our session, and I'm concerned that maybe you felt like I was giving you a hard time.
I think that is, I suspect that's rare that not many therapists do that, but it sounds like that would communicate a very caring kind of message.
Right. And I think that if you say what you think the client might be thinking, that gives them permission to talk about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the other goals of the first session is to help you ask questions to help people understand what kind of things can they talk about? They're learning you and they're learning your approach. And they only know this by what you ask them. You know, so that's why I ask a lot of things about process rather than about content, because that's important to me. But the follow-up, I mean, this again, you know, they use the analogy. This is where if you go shopping for a car and, you know, you don't buy one on the spot probably, this salesman is going to be calling you back later on that week. You know, he's going to be calling you up and going, hey, Bob, we met on Saturday, and I'm glad you came in. And if you got any other questions, you know, about that Ford whatevers, please give me a call. You know, they'll do whatever. And that's, and you know, at some point it's going to feel like harassment, but probably the one or two times they give you the call, you're going to appreciate it because they're showing interest in you.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would do that, you know, if you have any kind of hesitations about something that went badly in the session.
You know, I'm interested in the idea of question asking because sometimes asking too many questions sets up a situation where the client is being trained in passivity. That is, you ask questions and you're supposed to come up with a magical solution.
Yeah, and this is, again, in my mind, it's about kind of being deliberate and conscious. You know, my simple way of looking at that is, you ask questions to kind of dig into details and to unlock emotions. You make statements to help people feel calmer and safer. What you don't want to do is interrogate people. And so you're going to mix, you know, you're going to mix statements and questions. I'm conscious of giving people the intent behind my question if they ever make a face. You know, if I ask them, you know, and I ask them about, you know, is there any history of child abuse or something, and they kind of make a face or what happens, I'm going to explain to them why I'm asking that question and how it ties into their presenting problem, so they understand what makes them think. What people are going to feel unsafe with is me just feeling like I'm a loose gun that can just shoot at anything I want, and they start to get anxious.
Yeah.
So I need to help them understand what I think. But the other part you're talking about, too, is about therapy's a service, and therapy's their therapy. And one of the things I state pretty clearly is, you know, today I'm asking a lot of questions because I need to get some background, but I want you to come in with an agenda. You know, I want you to feel like this is your thing. I don't want it to be where they're passive and I'm the one driving the boat, you know, every session. And it doesn't take long for me to train them to do that. You know, if I do that two sessions in a row, they're going to expect it.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard to break the pattern.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so I absolutely believe you got to, you know, have them step up. And that's one of the reasons I give people homework. You know, the message about homework is the work is out there. It ain't sitting in my office.
What would be some examples of homework?
Well, obviously it depends on the problem. You want to link it to whatever the theme of the session was. But, for you know, I have certain standard ones. You know, a lot of them in the beginning are simple and just observational. So, for example, if I'm seeing someone who's coming in for anger management, they have trouble with their anger, one of their homework assignments might be, okay, what I'd like you to do is because what happens, it sounds like you're a kind of guy that goes from 0 to 60 real quickly and you don't catch it. What I'd like you to do is check in with yourself once an hour and on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being that you feel, 1 being that you are flatlined and in good shape, 10 being you're getting crazy. Just check in with yourself and see where you're at. You know, when you get to 4 or 5, I want you to ask yourself what's going on. You know, is there something that's bothering me? Is there a problem to fix? Whatever. So it's that kind of observational kind of thing. One of the things I do for couples, for example, is I say, okay, you know, one of the things you told me is, I understand you have arguments at home, you know, that you're concerned about and get out of hand, but it also sounds like on your job you both do well, you know. And so one of the things I'd like you to try, and I call it a business meeting, is I'd like you to schedule a time sometime this week when it's not 11:30 at night, you're not drunk, you're not tired, you're going to do it when you're sane, like 9 o'clock on Saturday morning after you had a cup of coffee or whatever. But you're going to have a business meeting, and you're going to pretend you're at work. And you're going to have an agenda. You're going to think about it during the week. And you're going to come in with this mindset of, I'm at work, and what's the purpose of my agenda item? It could be we're going to plan next weekend. It could be we're going to talk about Tuesday night. We're going to talk about whatever. but you're going to stay sane. You're going to try to not get emotional. You're only going to do this for like 20 minutes, because if you do it more than that, you're going to fall apart. But I'd like you to try it. And I want them to nod their heads when I say this.
Yeah.
To make sure they understand it. And we'll see if they do it. Now, one of the advantages of homework is you also get a sense of are they on board with you? If they do the homework, that means they're on board with you in terms of they see the purpose of it. You know, if they don't do it, they go, oh, yeah, no, we were going to do it, but, you know, we got busy and kind of forgot. Is it about you? They don't really see the connection between the homework and what they were talking about in the session. Is it because it was too scary and they get overwhelmed by it and they got too anxious? I don't know, but I'm going to ask the question. But it becomes a good barometer for me of where they might be getting stuck in working with me.
Yeah. I'm struck by how closely you're monitoring their facial expressions and so on and kind of tracking, you know, are they on board?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we're back to the good salesman. I mean, they're looking at that stuff all the time. But you want to be able to do that. You know, you want to be able to see, you know, there's in the sales world, they talk a lot about objections, you know, that you need to be able to answer people's objections when they go, I don't know if I can afford $400 for whatever.
Yeah.
And you need to be able to address it. But you're also, again, looking for that lockstep kind of thing, because part of it is if you're walking in lockstep and they can see a connection between their concerns and your solution and feel confident in your abilities, then you won't get the resistance. I mean, that's what we're talking about. You know?
Yeah.
It won't be resistant. You get resistance because something breaks bad. They don't see the connection. You're going too fast. It's too overwhelming. You know, something. And then your job isn't, you don't have to figure it out. You just need to ask the question.
Yeah,
how come you didn't do the homework? You know, without
right.
sounding scolding, because you don't want to sound like Mary's father.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the bumps in the road that you discuss is the silent or inhibited client.
Yeah.
How do you handle that situation?
They're teenagers are good for this one.
Yeah, really.
Stare at your shoes. don't want to talk. It's about, you know, I mean, there's a whole literature of what kind of, you know, what's going on with silence. You know, there's the angry silence and there's the ambivalent silence and there's the shutdown kind of silence, you know, and so part of it is, you know, your own skill in kind of picking up the vibe in the room. You know, is the client shutting down because they're overwhelmed? Are they shutting down because they don't feel safe? Are they feeling angry about something? My rule of thumb is you try to, same thing as you do with the follow-up phone call, where you try to say what you think the client may be thinking. The silence is, you know, one of my simple dictums is whatever you think is a problem is a bad solution for the client. You know, affairs are bad solutions to problems, spending money, or whatever. But silence is a bad solution. You know, it's not the problem. It's a solution to something else. And so what you're curious about is what's going on. So you say what you think might be going on. You know, are you feeling overwhelmed? Are you feeling nervous? Did you feel like I was giving you a hard time? Are you feeling upset with me? And again, you want to get underneath people's defenses, especially if they're feeling any of these things. So you're always going to intentional. You know, one of the things I think we don't do enough with in terms of training therapists is on this subtle, how do you use your voice kind of stuff? How do you, it's almost like acting, I guess, but it's not.
Yes, right.
But it is, but you want to be intentional with that. But, you know, if I have someone who I think is really, really anxious and they're shutting down, you know, I got to sound like Mr. Rogers. You know, I'm going to go, you know, it seems that you're quiet and, you know, I don't know what you're thinking, but I'm wondering if you're feeling a little nervous or whatever. And I got to sound like that on purpose, because it's how I sound that's going to help their defenses drop.
Yeah, fascinating.
And that's why we're back to transference cues. If I go, what the hell is going on? Well, they're going to shut down even more.
Yeah,
because now I sound like their mother or their father or who knows whatever.
Right.
And with silent, you know, and with silent clients, you want to make statements rather than questions. That's what I was saying before. I think questions tend to raise people's anxiety. They're good for drilling into stuff, but they raise anxiety. Statements help are soothing, and they help people feel safe.
Yeah.
So you want to make more statements. So it's, you know, so you say it. Say that too.
Hey, I want to jump back to the beginning of our session where you mentioned Skype, and there's a whole emerging thing of telemedicine, emailing, texting.
Yeah.
What role are these technologies playing in your work? And, you know, where do you see that stuff going? Is that an appropriate direction for psychotherapy? Or, you know, what are your thoughts?
I've had limited use of it. I've had, for example, I'm in a university town. So if I have college students who go away for the summer, you know, I've used Skype for having contact with them during the summer, things like that. The technology isn't as sophisticated as I'd like at times. You know, you get the kind of, you know, the fuzzy pictures or the sound's not right, and that's sort of frustrating. I don't think it replaces having a body in the room, where you can pick up better subtle cues, changes in things. You don't have the distance of the screen in between you. But I think, you know, for a lot of folks, or even using telephone stuff, for people who are isolated, a thousand years ago, I started, back in the 80s, I'm thinking I was cutting edge, I tried to start a telephone counseling service where people would just talk to me on the phone.
Yeah.
And this was before it was hot, but part of the idea behind it was that a lot of people were just scared to death to come to an office. You know, obviously now people are doing it all the time in terms of chat rooms and talking. But for clients who are inhibited, people who can't get in, people who are isolated, you know, I think using Skype, using phone calls, I think that can be really, really powerful. Or for people who do just, you know, simply move away. You know, they've had a long-standing relationship with a therapist. They may not go every week, but they're the go-to person when they're having a hard time or in crisis. And the fact that they moved to Wyoming, you know, and have to start with somebody new? No. You know, Skype them, talk on the phone. I think that's great.
Okay.
You know, we do it with our families.
Yeah, that's
it kind of works.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
They could try it here. So I think that's going to, you know, I think that's going to increase for a lot of folks. For a lot of reasons.
Well, as we wind down, is there anything else you'd like to add?
We'll have symmetry here in your opening question, you know, what's behind all this. And again, the idea is hopefully what I was trying to do in the book is to kind of lay out one course of how to think about the first session. The bigger purpose of the book, though, is to help people just think about how they run the first session, you know, to be intentional about that. And actually, I even have a chapter in the book where I talk about, even if you don't want to use my model, are there parts and bits of it that you might want to try out in your own practice? You know, like how do you need to think in terms of treatment maps so you can hit the ground running? You know, how do you need to present your website so that it pulls in the kind of clients that you most want to reach? You know, how do you think about intentionally changing the emotional climate just so people will feel differently than when they walked in? You know, and I think these are just ideas and concepts that people can try out. I believe therapy is a very pragmatic sport. You know, it's not about doing it right, it's about doing it different. And so the idea of kind of just trying things out, being intentional, you know, realizing that people come in with expectations and are looking for something by the time they leave, I think that helps you shape what you want to do and to just think about that.
Well, that's a great wrap-up, and I think your book succeeds at that. Robert Taibbi, I want to thank you for being my guest
today.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed doing this.
I have to say, I really enjoyed Robert Taibbi's energy during this interview. Clearly, his personality is a great fit for the style of work that he's doing. I suspect that therapists in general probably end up practicing an approach that fits with their particular personality. If by some chance they end up practicing with something that does not fit their personality very well, it would be hard to imagine that they would be getting very good results. Clearly, Bob is working in a short-term format, and I'm not sure how good a fit it would be for more long-term, exploratory, depth psychology approaches such as psychoanalysis or Jungian analysis. His emphasis on approaching psychotherapy in terms of sales certainly is unique in my reading experience. At the same time, I have to say I found it refreshing and realistic in terms of today's environment. As you heard, I was really struck by some of the statistics he cited. For example, over 70% of clients coming from online searches, the average client coming to therapy only 5 to 8 times, and most only once, and 70% of clients dropping out before reaching their goals. These modern realities are a far cry from the training I received back in the 1960s. I have to say that my academic training seemed to be predicated on an ivory tower model that was pretty far removed from the economic realities of even that time. Even in my doctoral program, private practice was assumed to be something that one would perhaps enter after many years of postdoctoral experience and an abundance of gray hair. The idea that someone would immediately, after the PhD, let alone after a master's degree, jump into private psychotherapy was deemed as pretty much unthinkable. Consequently, there was no coverage of the realities of private practice in terms of it essentially being a business. So, yes, there is the healing of psyches and souls, but there's also the renting of an office, the purchase of insurance, the purchase of suitable furniture, business cards, and so on. So I think that Bob's approach is really grounded in the demands and expectations of today's clients. And I think his book will be very instructive, especially for therapists in training and newly minted therapists. And my guess is that many experienced therapists might benefit from his tips as well. As he pointed out, he doesn't expect his approach will be a perfect fit for everyone and really encourages the reader to mix and match ideas as fits their particular personality and situation. Bob dropped an email line after our interview letting me know how much he enjoyed the process and that he would be happy to come back anytime to talk about couples, families, kids, clinical supervision, or what he refers to as boot camp brief therapy. You can check out his website for his workshop schedule at bobtaibbi.com. And that's spelled bobtaibbi.com. As always, you can use the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar to purchase his book, The Art of the First Session, Making Psychotherapy Count.
Here's a little mindfulness exercise for you listeners of Shrink Wrap Radio. Whilst listening to an episode of Shrink Wrap Radio, when something really grabs you, and something will, write it down. Then, do a little mindfulness exercise. You can do the usual body scanning thing to relax yourself. Observe thoughts coming into and letting them go out of your head, etc. Then, when you feel calm, take a look at each of those things that grabbed you, individually. Read one, close your eyes, and let thoughts about that point come in and out of your mind. You'll find that there's a reason why those things grabbed you enough to write them down, and exploring them in this way can reveal insights you might not have been expecting. Then, when you finish your list, you'll be in the ideal, appreciative frame of mind to go onto the Shrink Wrap Radio website and click on that big, round Support Shrink Wrap Radio button. After all, gratitude will only bring greater joy to yourself and help maintain the flow of mind food for further personal development. It is totally selfish, really.
Thank you, Simon Huggins, who has been a longtime supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio. If you're not already a financial supporter of this show, I hope you'll be mindful, as Simon suggests, of just how much value you're receiving. Unfortunately, there are no new donors to announce or new transcripts at this time. Earlier, I mentioned the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar that you can use for ordering any books you wish, such as today's book by Robert Taibbi, but not only books, but anything at Amazon. I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things. If you'll use the search tool in our widget in the right-hand sidebar, it will automatically add our affiliate code, and shrink wrap will get a small percentage of the purchase. So it's yet another way that you can help to support us. Now, the trick is, when you go to that widget, instead of typing in the name of a book, if you'll just click on the black part at the bottom of the widget, that takes you to Amazon, where you can do a search for anything that you're interested in. And as I say, our affiliate code will be added. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, my recommendation today may surprise you. I say that because in the past, I've confessed my love of crime novels, especially Scandinavian noir, and courtroom dramas and spy novels about the current hot spots around the world. Well, this past week, I was searching for a good book to listen to, and I found I was tired of my usual fare. I was like a kid who had overindulged on candy. I felt like I had just reached my limit of all that often too predictable stuff. So I surprised myself by downloading an American classic, which some have considered to be the great American novel. I'm referring to The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. I saw part of the movie that came out a few years ago, and it was so awful, I thought, that I walked out after the first 10 minutes or so. Yuck. So I figured the book must be better than that. And I'm sure I read the book, but so long ago that I really don't remember it at all. I've started to listen to the audiobook, and the use of language makes it clear why it's been held in such high regard. Let me play you a little sample, read by Jake Gyllenhaal.
I graduated from New Haven in 1915, just a quarter of a century after my father, and a little later I participated in that delayed Teutonic migration known as the Great War. I enjoyed the counter raid so thoroughly that I came back restless. Instead of being the warm center of the world, the Middle West now seemed like the ragged edge of the universe. So I decided to go east and learn the bond business. Everybody I knew was in the bond business, so I supposed it could support one more single man. All my aunts and uncles talked it over as if they were choosing a prep school for me, and finally said, "Why, yes," with very grave, hesitant faces. Father agreed to finance me for a year, and after various delays, I came east, permanently, I thought, in the spring of 22. The practical thing was to find rooms in the city, but it was a warm season, and I had just left a country of wide lawns and friendly trees. So when a young man at the office suggested that we take a house together in a commuting town, it sounded like a great idea. He found the house, a weather-beaten cardboard bungalow, at 80 a month. But at the last minute, the firm ordered him to Washington, and I went out to the country alone. I had a dog, at least I had him for a few days until he ran away, and an old Dodge and a Finnish woman, who made my bed and cooked breakfast and muttered Finnish wisdom to herself over the electric stove. It was lonely for a day or so, until one morning some man, more recently arrived than I, stopped me on the road. "How do you get to West Egg Village?" he asked helplessly. I told him, and as I walked on, I was lonely no longer. I was a guide, a pathfinder, an original settler. He had casually conferred on me the freedom of the neighborhood. And so with the sunshine and the great bursts of leaves growing on the trees, just as things grow in fast movies, I had that familiar conviction that life was beginning over again with the summer. There was so much to read, for one thing, and so much fine health to be pulled down out of the young, breath-giving air. I bought a dozen volumes on banking and credit and investment securities, and they stood on my shelf in red and gold, like new money from the mint, promising to unfold the shining secrets that only Midas and Morgan and Maecenas knew.
And it goes on from there. Does this mean I'll switch to listening to classics rather than my customary junk food listening? Only time will tell, but Gatsby has given my literary taste buds a chance to heal. So if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, they now have more than 180,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is Gary Trostclair, LCSW Jungian analyst and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks to Jungian analyst Gary Trostclair for that transition. Synchronistically, Gary's interview on episode number 479 was on how to get the most out of psychotherapy. I think there's a certain similarity to Bob Taibbi's book on getting the most out of the first session. Moreover, both have a degree in social work. I got some short emails from our listener community in response to my putting a 3-minute video clip in the stream of my interview with my guest Nathan Ehrlich as a preview of my episode with him. It's the first time I've ever done anything like that, and so I asked for listener feedback. Mayar in Tehran writes in part, "Dear Dr. Dave, I just saw the clip you put on the website. I think that's a great idea. It lets me, as a listener, feel like being in the situation with you and your guest. But before, I used to imagine how the setting looked like. Now, my imagination seems shipwrecked. But I really like the rug on your wall. I'm wondering, where does it come from, as I've seen rugs with the same patterns in Iran?" Thanks very much for that observation, Mayar. And yes, I do have a Persian-style rug hanging on my office wall, and I think it's very likely that it is actually from Iran, but I don't know for sure. It might be a copy. Amy wrote in the comments area, "I love seeing the face behind the microphone in action. It definitely adds another dimension to the interview. A short snippet is great." And Jim writes, "I very much liked the video clip of your upcoming interview. To see just a clip of you and your guest added wonderful color and warmth to a great podcast. Thanks for the effort." And thank you, Jim, for that feedback. And Ralph weighed in with, "Dear Doctor, love your show, longtime subscriber. I have the podcast on auto download. I freaked when the video popped onto the screen. We're okay. I can only hope that the video podcast would have a separate address than the audio podcast, for my little phone does not do well with videos. It's a memory thing for my device and for me. I'm impaired and use audio for most of my info stuff. Thank you and many blessings." And that's from Ralph Cruz. Well, Ralph, I hope it did not create too big a problem. I sort of worried about that, how it might affect some people, and wasn't sure just how it would come up in the stream and on the Shrink Wrap Radio app. But it's something that you don't have to load onto your phone, and you can just ignore it. Okay? So I think with that, we'll wrap it up for today. As always, you can send emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. And you can also use our app to do that. Thanks to today's guest, Robert Taibbi, LCSW, for sharing his thoughts and tips on the art of the first session. And my next guest will be British Jungian analyst Anne Baring, who will be a keynote speaker at the 2016 conference of the International Association for the Study of Dreams, which will be held in the Netherlands, June 24 through June 28 of 2016. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.